Okay, why have a morning given over to this question, did Jesus rise from the dead? I'm just going to do a very brief introduction, and then I'm going to introduce the two people who will be leading us on this. But before that, just something to hopefully focus upon that question. Now, famous people often have notable epitaphs, and here are a few. I want to see if you can guess who they are. These are what are on their tombstones. This one's quite an easy one. I think you'll get this. Free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. Whose is that? Martin Luther King. Well done, Peterson. Yep, Martin Luther King. This one's a bit harder. She's famous, but I don't know if you get this one. On hers is, I will return and I will be millions. I will be millions. Eva Perón, that's in Buenos Aires. Now, I don't get that as well, but there you go. Here's one. He helped people to see God in the ordinary things of life, and he made children laugh. He helped see God in the ordinary things of life, and he made children laugh. No, good try. Good try. It's the Reverend W. Audrey, famous for Thomas the Tank Engine. And he chose that himself. And here's another one chosen by himself. Well, this is what he requested. I don't know if it ever actually got there. Here lies Groucho Marx, and lies, and lies, and lies. P.S. He never kissed an ugly girl. That apparently is. And one that wasn't meant to be funny, but is. A wife had this written on her husband's tombstone after he died. Here lies John Smith. Thou art at rest until we meet again. And that one is there somewhere. Anyway, I could go on, but I won't. The point is, anyone who's famous has died has a resting place, or at least a place where people can go and pay tribute to their lives. But not Jesus Christ. At the heart of the Christian faith is the belief that Jesus rose bodily from the dead. And if you really believe that, then it has to change the way that you see him. Even more than that, I think it changes the way that you see the world that we live in now, and also the world that is to come too. But the question is, what if he hasn't risen from the dead? What is if it's all based on a terrible mistake, or even actually a downright lie that was made up by the first disciples of Jesus? In the New Testament, one of its writers answers that question. He writes this. It was someone called Paul, and he wrote these words. If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. So it's as blunt as that. It's a true statement. If Christ did not rise on the third day, then actually Christianity is based on a lie. It should be dismissed. And actually, anyone who's a Christian should actually be pitied, because they're basing their lives on something that is false. So in this time, we want to ask a simple question, but it's an incredibly important one. Did Jesus rise from the dead? And to do that, we've got two barristers. One will argue for the resurrection, and one will argue against. The one who's arguing for, on my right, is Malcolm Chisholm. Malcolm studied at Cambridge University. He was called to the bar in 1989. He now practices family law from One Garden Court Law Chambers in London. He specialises in several areas of family law and is part-time president of the Mental Health Review Tribunal. The one who's arguing against is on my left, and that's Charles Fuster. He also studied at Cambridge University, now practices primarily medical law from the Outer Temple Chambers in London. As well as contributing to many legal books, he teaches medical law and ethics at the University of Oxford. And he's published a book which is called The Jesus Inquest, which looks at the case for and against the resurrection of Jesus. Both will debate, and then after they've debated, there'll be an opportunity for any of us here to ask questions. Charles, who is against, will go first. So I'll hand it over to them, both, Charles and Malcolm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Got the scanner for it. Did Jesus rise from the dead? The evidence strongly suggests that he didn't. The evidence for and against is copious. We haven't got time to deal with it all. What we're going to do is to deal with the evidence relating to the death of Jesus, and then we're going to move to the evidence relating to some of the alleged post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. A little while ago, there was an archaeological excavation. It tunneled underneath the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The archaeologists broke into a chamber. The chamber had been sealed since the first century. They broke down the door, and in the corner of the room into which they'd broken, there was a large earthenware jar, about 4 feet tall. As they pulled the jar aside, the jar broke, and they were able to look into it. It was clear from the working on the pot that it came from Second Temple times, so round about the time of the death of Jesus. One of them took a torch and peered inside the broken jar. When he looked inside the jar, he said to the archaeologist who was standing beside him, "You better look at this. Am I seeing things right?" The other archaeologist looked in and saw something which surprised him very much. He said to the first archaeologist, "We need to get somebody to look at this of international authority and a specialist on the Second Temple period. He must be of impeccable independence. He must be of vaulting learning. And above all, he must not be a Jew." Hold that story in your head. Two men lived next door to one another. One of them had a dog, and the other had a rabbit. One day, the dog owner was horrified to see the dog running into his backyard. In the jaws of the dog was the next door neighbor's rabbit, stone dead. The man was extremely embarrassed about this. He prized the rabbit out of the dog's jaws, washed it off, used the hairdryer to blow it dry, and then at dead of night he went into the next door neighbor's property and placed the rabbit in the hutch. A week or so later, the rabbit owner was talking with the dog owner, and they were asking one another how things were, and the rabbit owner said, "Yeah, well, things are all right, but a very strange thing happened the other day. Our rabbit died. We gave it a good Christian burial with prayers to make things better for the children. And then some sicko dug it up and put it back in the hutch." Now, I tell that story to indicate that when it comes to death and burial, things are not always what they seem. In order to indicate in relation to the death of Jesus that things aren't necessarily all that they might seem, one has to look at the accounts which purport to tell the story. There are four of them: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This relates to something I'll be saying earlier in the context of the post-resurrection appearances, but understand this. The basic document everybody agrees is the Gospel of Mark. Matthew and Luke had the Gospel of Mark in front of them when they were composing their own Gospels. Matthew and Luke also had some other material, which doesn't matter for these purposes. The Gospel of Mark was probably written sometime or committed to papyrus sometime around the 40s or 50s. Matthew and Luke came later. Nobody really knows the dates or the order. John, everybody agrees, came later than all the other three. It was probably written by John sitting somewhere in the Eastern Mediterranean, possibly on Ephesus. He probably had both Matthew and Mark and possibly Luke in front of him as well, but he also seems to have had some of his own recollection. Now, what do these people say about the death of Jesus? Well, note two things. Mark is the source upon whom Luke and Matthew relied. So let's look at him and compare him with John. Mark, if you read the gospel accounts, is a very staccato writer. His writing has been described as a string of pearls. His account up until the death of Jesus is lots of events strung together in a rather artless way. Event, event, event. No artistic attempt to smooth things out. John's completely different. John is obviously a very learned man. John's a literary man. He puts in lots of artifice. There are lots of rhetorical flourishes in John until we get to what both Mark and John say about the death of Jesus. Mark completely changes his tone. String of pearls no longer. He becomes mellifluous. He becomes literary. Why? There's only one real explanation. Because he doesn't have any more real events upon which to base his account. So his imagination is forced to generate the story. With John, it's completely different. He becomes much more like Mark. He becomes much more staccato. His literary style changes completely. Why? Because he's not in his usual factual territory. He's got to make it up. Did Jesus die on the cross? There are some significant indicators that he might not have done. Perhaps he wasn't there at all. You'll remember the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail story, which was the basis on which Dan Brown wrote his Da Vinci Code. That's based on the Gospel of John. John puts the death of Jesus in a garden, and we have this curious character, Joseph of Arimathea, who doesn't appear anywhere apart from the death narratives of Jesus. Because it was a garden, John might have had a good deal of control over what went on in the crucifixion in that garden. Is it improbable that Joseph of Arimathea arranged it so that this man, Jesus, wasn't crucified at all? The Quran, after all, a book of impeccable authority, suggests that Jesus was not the man on the cross at all, that somebody else substituted for him. The Gospel of Barnabas said similar things. Judas, in the Gospel of Barnabas, a very, very old document indeed, looked very like Jesus and was crucified instead of him. So perhaps he wasn't there at all. But if he was, did he die? You will remember, everybody who's read the Gospel accounts remembers, that there is, at the trial of Jesus, an extraordinary electricity passing between Pilate and Jesus. Pilate clearly doesn't want to kill this man, and Pilate was influenced by his wife. Many of us know the power of an authoritative wife, not to be messed with. If Pilate didn't want Jesus dead, as he plainly didn't, it was well within his power to save Jesus. Just a word in the ear of those Roman soldiers who were guarding the cross would have made sure that Jesus didn't die. Just a couple of shekels to people to keep quiet about Jesus not dying. That's a speculation. Is there anything to support it? Jesus died very quickly indeed. He seems to be in control of the situation. He asks for a bit of sour wine or vinegar, which is handed out to him on a sponge, and immediately after that, he appears to die. It looks as if Jesus is stage managing his own death. What was in that vinegar or that sour wine? A little while ago, the then Australian ambassador to Israel was extremely interested in archaeology, and he dug up some very curious little pots. The pots were in the shape of a seed. The Australian ambassador got those pots analyzed, and gas chromatography indicated that what was in those pots was opium. Opium was ubiquitous throughout the Eastern Mediterranean in Second Temple times. And opium is still used, as many of you know, as a potent oral analgesic. It also has the effect of depressing respiration. If you want to knock somebody out, if you want to depress his respiration so it looks as if he's dead, if you want to make the agonies of coming down from a cross diminish so that somebody doesn't scream and give the game away. Opium's the stuff you want. But was the crucifixion something which people could survive? Absolutely. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells stories of many people who survived this not tremendously traumatic crucifixion. In 1968, in the northern Jerusalem suburb of Givat Mifta, there was an excavation of a second temple site, and a tomb was uncovered. In that tomb, there was a skeleton of a Jewish man called Jonathan. We know his name because it's written there in Hebrew. Jonathan is a very important man because Jonathan had been crucified, and he's the only crucified Jew from that period his body has been discovered. Jonathan's hands weren't pierced. Jonathan's hands had been tied to the cross. Jonathan's ankles had been nailed to the cross on either side. But the point of that story is that this was not necessarily a very traumatic injury. People did survive this process. If he survived, where did he go? Well, if you believe Dan Brown, he survived in order to father children and start the Merovingian dynasty. But you don't have to believe everything that Dan Brown says. There are much earlier and much more credible stories than that. If you go into eastern Turkey, if you wander through Afghanistan, you see villages which are named after Jesus. You see villages which have folk memories of Jesus and his mother Mary and a man called Thomas wandering through them sometime in the first centuries after the supposed death of Jesus. And that trail leads all the way to Kashmir, to Srinagar. In the heart of Srinagar, there is a tomb. The tomb is supposed to be of a man called Yusasif. And it's a very interesting tomb. It was originally painted in blue and white. Very odd, that, for the Kashmiri region. They're the classic colors of Jewish burials. The tomb is orientated in a way that you'd expect for a Jewish burial. A little while ago, somebody was clearing away some of the wax which had covered the stones on the immediate outside of the tomb. And they found some footprints which had been carved into the stone by the rock. Those feet were very interesting because marked clearly on them were the marks of nails. What we're dealing with there is the tomb of Yusasif, which translates beautifully out of Hindi into Hebrew as Jesus. This man survived. There's no resurrection story to talk about.
The idea that there isn't enough evidence to conclude whether Jesus died on the cross is an old forensic trick, and it's completely see-through. Rumpole, who you'll be familiar with, used to say, he was very fond of saying, when he really had to scrape the bottom of the barrel, there's a golden thread running through British justice, and that is that the prosecution have to make you sure of guilt. Now, that's fine if you're being asked to decide between guilt, which can happen in only one way, and non-guilt, which can typically happen in an infinite number of different ways. But that's not what we have here. We have two possibilities only, death and non-death. If you're not sure that Jesus died, then you must live with the possibility that he lived. And if you think that he might have lived, then you're immediately into the realms of, I suggest, fantasy, far more exotic than anything the Christians have ever actually believed or said. Perfectly true it is, to take Mr. Foster's first point, that the gospel writers appear to change their tone when they get to what we describe as the passion stories. Mark's narrative does in fact get smoother, and John gets less obviously theological. But there's no great mystery about this, I suggest. Marcus felt able to jump quickly between often geographically very different scenes because of the relative unimportance of those scenes. Relative, that is, in comparison to what he's now dealing with. He's finally got to, in other words, the climax. That's what the whole story's about, and he's not going to skimp now. The story itself provides the form and the pace. He doesn't need to think about blending tales together, which he never bothered to do, because the events do it perfectly well for him. When you're dealing with events like the Passion, you don't have to worry about something sounding fancy. And it all happens fairly fast in a small area. John, yes, he leaves his beloved metaphors of the Messiah behind, but that's a reason, in fact, I suggest, to trust his historical accuracy all the more, not to doubt it more. Nowhere does John's testimony stink more of obvious eyewitness testimony than when he embarks on the Passion and the Resurrection stories. He gets a new earnestness, if you like, assuring his readers, I was there. People complain, a point not taken by Mr. Foster, about the curtain in the temple being torn from top to bottom. People say, well, there's no corroboration for that. I say this, we certainly don't know that this didn't happen. We have several ancient documents known to be reliable in many other contexts to say that it did. True, there's no corroboration outside the Christian accounts, but to think that this in itself casts significant doubt on the story is to misunderstand the sources. There really isn't very much literature from these periods. Secular historians rely significantly on the uniquely detailed and well-observed Christian documents for their knowledge. And if the temple veil had been ripped, and the rip was associated in time and in gossip with the death of Jesus, Jewish accounts may well have suppressed the account to avoid boosting the Christian camp. And the Romans, well, they probably couldn't have cared less. The possibility then that Jesus wasn't in fact crucified. Well, the Quran says that he wasn't. But it's important to remember why the idea of Jesus' crucifixion is so abhorrent to Muslims. It's because Jesus for them was a great prophet, beloved of Allah, and to say that Allah would allow one of his favored ones to be done to death in this way is to doubt Allah's power and benevolence. So the Quran statement is a theological one about the nature of God. It's not directly addressing the historical question of what happened on Calvary, and it was in any event written in the 7th century AD. So while the Quran's comment is important in understanding many later views about the historical accuracy of Jesus, it does not help this historical inquiry. The Gospel of Barnabas, cited by many Muslims as authority for the proposition that Judas was crucified instead of Jesus, is thought by the huge majority of mainstream scholars to be a medieval forgery. Some, however, think it may preserve some remnants of an early apocryphal text which has been edited into conformity with Islam. The two earliest known manuscripts have been dated to the late 16th century, one in Italian, one in Spanish. The earliest Spanish version still surviving is an 18th century copy, and its deployment by Islamic apologists is very recent. It's only sprung to prominence, in fact, in the last 50 years. There's a crushing consensus on the value of the Gospel of Barnabas as a source on the life and death of Jesus, and that consensus is that the Gospel is worthless. The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, a popular book, but buys no serious converts. What would have been involved in a conspiracy of the sort to which Mr. Foster has referred? Well, was it a last-minute plan? Surely it would have to have been, since the arrest of Jesus in Gethsemane and the subsequent murderous course could not have been anticipated. That gave the conspirators a very short time to concoct this plan. Who were they? Jesus wasn't noted for his friends in high places. Anyway, whoever they were, they would have had to arrange a private crucifixion, contrary to everything we know about Roman crucifixions, which were, by definition, obscenely public. If Mr. Bagent, the author of The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, is right, the conspirators apparently arranged for two thieves to be crucified in the same private place so that it didn't look too suspicious. They presumably kept the crowds angry at being deprived of their Friday afternoon outing out of the garden at Spearpoint. And it was a shame that the conspirators couldn't stop people looking in, but no doubt those people had terrible eyesight and could not in any event notice the switch of bodies, although they could apparently see blood and water oozing out and hear Jesus talking. Or was that made up, and if so, by whom and why? And in any event, there was a lot of bribing to be done. Pilate, very importantly, then the soldiers, then the others who had slipped through the cordon at the entrance to the garden. Very tricky, too, you'd have thought, to grease the palms of the watching Jewish officials, who seemed genuinely keen to have the real Jesus dead. It was just as well that there was someone who happened to look like Jesus, who was prepared to be crucified on his behalf that day, or had to be crucified in any event. And when was the switch made? It was presumably in the garden. Jesus had to go through the trials and the flogging. The crowd knew perfectly well who he was. They would have spotted a substitute. So Jesus would presumably have had to be exchanged for his substitute just before that substitute was nailed to the cross. And presumably he took refuge immediately in the nearby tomb. At this stage, of course, it was still broad daylight. All the stuff about Joseph then is pure fantasy. And Jesus, as well as churlishly accepting the offer of a substitute to die on his behalf, would have had to abandon all his followers immediately and make off as soon as the coast was clear. And somehow, that doesn't really seem like him. If there was a pre-made plan, Jesus would presumably have been in on it. He would have had to be agreed to be arrested, tried, flogged, subjected to the fake crucifixion before creeping off into obscurity. And why on earth would he do that? If his main objective was to save his own skin, and he knew what was in store for him in Jerusalem, as he would have had to have done in order for the plan to be made in the first place, why not spare himself all the bother and simply not come to Jerusalem? And if the anonymous friends in high places knew about a plot on his life, why not just tell him to steer clear of the danger? You have to ask, too, why every single one of the Gospels says what it does about the crucifixion. Were they all concocted as part of the conspiracy to mislead? But credit where credit's due. Mr. Bajan and his book is a good read, like many other fairy stories. Pilate, let's turn to him. He doesn't seem like the sort of man to have been moved by a brief meeting with a Galilean peasant. Elsewhere, Mr. Foster is quite happy to outline the historical evidence about Pilate's grotesque insensitivity and his self-interest, and I'm happy to adopt that. Pilate, from everything we know about him, was cruel and he was self-obsessed. Mr. Foster says, though, that Jesus affected him so deeply that after a few minutes of chat, Pilate was prepared to act in a career-endangering way by entering into an elaborate conspiracy. If this was discovered by the Jews, there would have been big trouble. And again, to repeat what I said in answering the contentions in relation to the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, it was a conspiracy put together with quite astonishing speed. But there's a more obvious objection to the Pilate as chief conspirator theory. Let's suppose he did have some sort of deep religious experience as he gazed into the dark eyes of the Galilean peasant. Let's suppose he had been henpecked by a superstitious wife into acting compassionately. Why not then just refuse to kill Jesus? Yes, the crowds and the priests would have kicked up a bit of a fuss, but there were plenty of other options. Jesus could have been slung into jail for a while until tempers cooled and the crowd's wrath moved to the next budding Messiah. And then if Pilate still chose to be merciful, he could have been quietly released or sent away. What about Joseph of Arimathea? Well, first of all, if he engineered Jesus' survival, he was more than just a casual friend. Remember, he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was risking their lethal wrath, and to help a condemned blasphemer was to be a potentially condemned blasphemer. Second, the notion that he could have simply bought the Roman soldiers off with a few shekels is laughable. There's a Roman novel called Satyricon in which the Roman soldier, having been deputed to guard the corpses of crucified men, lets one go missing and is so terrified of punishment that he contemplates suicide. How much greater, then, would the punishment have been for a soldier who allowed a crucifixion victim to survive and be carried off? Riches beyond a man's wildest dreams would have been needed to pay the bribes of all the people who would have needed to have been paid off. Did anyone survive crucifixion? Yes, they did, but it was a huge rarity. And it was precisely because it was such a rarity that Josephus, the historian, mentions it. Was the vinegar or the wine all it seemed? Mr. Foster says that Jesus died, in inverted commas, immediately after getting the vinegar, in inverted commas, and that implies something sinister. Well, plainly the gospel writers didn't think so, or they wouldn't have believed in Jesus in the first place, or if they were involved in the conspiracy, have written down the very account from which people might have been able to guess that they were guilty. Jesus cried out in a loud voice, inconceivable, says my learned friend, in a man close to death, but it's a last agonized scream. He's not making speeches to an assembled multitude. To describe a request for a drink by a dying, dehydrated man as an indication that he is in control is surprising. If he was play-acting, surely he'd have brought the charade to an end long before. He was hanging there, after all, for hours. Was he really saying, just another couple of hours, and they won't think it suspicious when I appear to die? Now, what Mr. Foster says about the availability of opium and its pharmacological action is correct, but it was a very high-risk strategy. It's a profound respiratory depressant, as anyone who's heard of heroin addicts dying on the point of a needle will know. What Mr. Foster appears to envisage is Jesus going into a complete opiate coma. Only that would suppress breathing sufficiently for his body to look like a corpse. Only that would produce sufficient analgesia to prevent him wincing as his body was taken down from the cross. But unfortunately, his chances of surviving a coma of such depth would be highly remote. What about the speed with which Jesus died? Yes, it was quick, it sometimes could be. One of the more recent credible theories of the cause of death is that Jesus died from pulmonary embolism. That would produce a quick and sudden death. And remember that the death is only suspiciously quick if you've already signed up to one of the conspiracy theories. If Jesus survived, what happened to him? Well, first of all, the post-crucifixion Jesus in Islam, the Quran's description of a shelter given to Jesus and his mother could relate to any time of their lives, could be wholly metaphorical, and in any event could be anywhere in the Near East. There are plenty of peaceful hillsides watered by a fresh spring west of Srinagar. And the background to the Jesus in India stories in the Islamic notion that Jesus didn't die on the cross, but that he only appeared to have done so. Well, if you believe that, then you have to do something with Jesus after the time of his supposed crucifixion. And there has been no shortage of storytellers prepared to help you out. There are only two pieces of real evidence about Jesus in India. Both have been laughed out of court by serious scholars. The first is the inscription on the pillar at the Takat Suleiman. How old is the inscription? It's unclear, although the mention in another book, the Tariq-e-Kashmir, suggests that it was there before 1420. Now let's assume it was indeed written in the year that the stonemason put on it of 54. The earliest date this could be is 78 AD. The latest is 107. And what does the inscription amount to? Well, that somebody calling himself Yusu Asaf declared his ministry then. And what was his ministry? Well, he said he was the prophet of the children of Israel. If this was Jesus, we have to ask ourselves, what had he been doing up until then? Most give his birth date at about 4 BC. That would make him 84 in 78 AD and 111 in 107 AD. And either is a ripe old age to declare your ministry, which sounds, in fact, very much like the start of a campaign. Was prophet of the children of Israel the sort of language that a defeated Jesus would have used of himself? Well, possibly. I suppose, if he'd given up all of his messianic ideas. But there's frankly not much point in proclaiming yourself prophet of the children of Israel when you're in India. It's a very bad campaign strategy. Far better if you think you have something spiritual to offer to proclaim yourself prophet of the children of Srinagar. So if the Yusuf Asaf of the Takate Suleiman pillar had anything whatever to do with the Jesus movement, he is hugely more likely to have been, in fact, an earlier missionary.
Well, post-resurrection appearances. This, for any anti-Christian campaigner, is like shooting rats in a barrel. You originally had, in relation to the death and so on, four accounts: Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. By the time we get to the post-resurrection accounts, Mark's gone missing. He has absolutely nothing whatever to say about any of these things. Now, Mark is a rather unfortunate casualty for a Christian apologist because, of course, Mark is the one fundamental document upon which the other three have relied. Now, he goes off, and what's left? Answer, imagination is left. And when imagination runs free in the supernatural milieu of first century Palestine, some extraordinary things happen. Let's deal, first of all, with Matthew. One would have thought that Matthew would have quite a lot to say about these post-resurrection appearances. After all, according to the Gospel of Matthew, the resurrection of Jesus is the whole point. Yet, of the whole Gospel, only four verses purport in Matthew to deal with actual appearances of the risen Jesus to witnesses. Four verses out of the whole Gospel. It sounds as if Matthew himself isn't convinced. And indeed, the people who Matthew says saw the risen Jesus themselves don't seem to be convinced by the story. Lots of people saw him, says Matthew. Some believed, some disbelieved. Well, if even some of the people who Matthew says saw Jesus disbelieve, then how are we supposed to do any better? Where does Matthew put the risen Jesus? He puts the risen Jesus entirely in Galilee. Where do the other gospel writers put the risen Jesus? Well, Luke puts the risen Jesus only in Jerusalem. John, who, as you'll remember, comes into the gospel writing business rather later than the others, hedges his bets. He puts the risen Jesus both in Jerusalem and in Galilee. Let's look at how those stories develop. Luke. It is perfectly plain from the words in Luke's gospel that the ascension of Jesus is supposed to take place on the very day that everybody saw Jesus rise. You'll remember you have this great Cape Canaveral type experience from the top of Mount Olives. They're all standing there and they see him whizzing up into the air. Luke changes his story by the time he gets to write the book of Acts, and he gives Jesus 40 days before the Cape Canaveral type experience. But it is plain that Luke puts Jesus in Jerusalem throughout the whole of those 40 days. What's the problem then for John? John, old, senile, sitting in Ephesus, scratching his bald head, wondering how to reconcile the two accounts, Luke and Matthew, which he's got in front of him. Problem. Luke, Jerusalem, Matthew, Galilee. Tell you what, I'll put him in both. So that's what he does. There's obviously an earlier ending of John's gospel. Look at it. John 20. The Jerusalem account is there. He plainly intends to end his first draft there. And then tacked on to the end is John 21, a completely different Galilee story. If a witness tacks on to their original witness statement a completely new version of events, saying, yes, and by the way, I now remember that there was a completely different set of really dramatic experiences in somewhere completely different, which I merely forgot to say the first time round, you begin to be suspicious about their credibility. What about Luke's story? On the day that Jesus rose, two men, Cleopas and a man who's not named, were walking along the Emmaus Road. And they meet a man. They chat with him all the way to Emmaus, incidentally, the location of which has never been definitively isolated. And then right at the end of the day, when they are having a meal together, they recognize that this man who they've been talking to all day is Jesus. Presumably, Cleopas and the other man are members of the cohort of disciples. Why on earth didn't they recognize this man who they had spent the previous 3 years shuffling around Palestine with? What makes them recognize Jesus? They recognize him when he breaks bread with them at the end of the day. And the terms in which the breaking of the bread happens at the end of the day are precisely those of the Last Supper. This isn't a historical story. This is a story which is designed to tell Christians that you will be able to have a continuing relationship with Jesus Christ through the Holy Communion service, which is, of course, precisely how huge numbers of people in the contemporary Christian world continue to relate to him. It's laying the ground for that. It's interesting, because Luke is still purporting to write history, that he doesn't give the two men wine with the Eucharistic feast because he wants them to be undrunk as they relate their story. He's still bolstering the historical story that he's telling. Then, when the two men come back to Jerusalem, they tell this story, and then Jesus miraculously appears in their midst. He doesn't go through the door, he doesn't go through the window, he doesn't come down the chimney, he doesn't use any of the usual methods that physical human beings use to get into a room. And yet, the Christians say that this is a physical body that we're talking about. Oh no, it isn't. But Luke's anxious to convince us that it's still a physical story. So he has this very artificial device of making Jesus ostentatiously eat a bit of fish in front of them. I've got a stomach, therefore I've got a body, therefore you can conclude various theologically important things about it. It's all a bit too obvious. John does similar things. You remember that famous story of Jesus eating fried fish cooked by Jesus on the beach in Galilee? Remember that story about Thomas reaching out his hand and not actually touching Jesus, but being able to touch Jesus? John's trying a bit too hard to make the physical point. What happened then? There was no physical resurrection. Where was the body of Jesus? Might have been on a rubbish tip in Jerusalem. Might have been put out for the jackals like the bodies of lots of other condemned criminals. There might not have been a body at all. That body might have wandered all the way to Kashmir. Why then should this myth be perpetuated in first century Palestine? Whatever you say about him, Jesus was a man of the most extraordinary magnetism and charisma. One can well understand how these disciples who had lived with him, who'd breathed these extraordinary words, might be entirely psychologically unable to give up the idea of Jesus. It's not uncommon. There was a 1971 study in the British Medical Journal which dealt with GPs' experiences of the visions of the deceased of wives and husbands who'd lost their spouses. A large proportion of them had seen compelling visions of the late departed. Perhaps it was something like that. In 1917, three young Spanish children said, "We believe that God is telling us that in 3 days' time there will be a great miracle performed over the farmland near here." So tens of thousands of credulous peasants poured out. It was supposed to happen at noon. And duly at noon, the sun approached the earth, and they all saw it. The power of the human imagination, when it wants to believe something, is a mighty force to be reckoned with. There are very few petrol stations and supermarkets in the southern states of the United States where there has not recently been a well-attested apparition of Elvis Presley. Going back to where I started, what was seen in that jar underneath the Temple Mount may have been the skeleton of a crucified Jew called Yeshua, with marks on his head consistent with a crown of thorns being pushed into it. Whatever the case, there is no reason to suppose that what happened to this magnetic, attractive man, Jesus of Nazareth, was not that which is not going to happen to the rest of us. He was a man, a great man, a compelling man, a poetic man, one who we can learn a great deal from. But somewhere, whether it's in Srinagar or Palestine or Glastonbury, his bones rest. Let's leave him there.
Mr. Foster can sometimes be very direct, but as is so often the case, directness betrays a real misunderstanding. His opening salvo, you will recall, was this: dealing with the post-resurrection accounts is like shooting rats in a barrel. I can see what he means. There are some significant differences which really have to be acknowledged. Notably, these relate to the places where the encounters happen. Luke, Jerusalem only. Matthew, Galilee only. John, Jerusalem and Galilee. And there's no doubt that Jesus behaves very oddly. He appears and disappears. He doesn't need to use doors. But although he can walk through walls, he can eat and drink. People who knew him for years don't recognize him at first. But for Mr. Foster to say that this odd behavior on Jesus' part suggests some sort of disorder of perception, credibility, or good faith on the part of the gospel writers is a very illuminating mistake. It shows that he thinks that the resurrection is not really a resurrection at all. He thinks it's a resuscitation. He's aiming his arrows at completely the wrong target. He's approaching the story as if what happened was that Jesus' body was revived in the tomb, walked out, and wandered off, making itself intermittently available for inspection by others, and then finally disappearing. That's never been the Christian story, and no real Christian apologetic will ever try to defend it. The Christian story is far bigger and stranger, and the Christians struggle unsuccessfully for language to describe it. Now, the resurrection of body of Jesus was like his old one in some respects. It had some continuity, in other words, with the old one. It bore the scars of his crucifixion. It sometimes spoke with a voice that was recognizably his. It sometimes looked like him to people who had known him, and sometimes it didn't. Sometimes it vanished as soon as it was recognized. It could be touched, but sometimes, for reasons that are very unclear, he didn't want it to be touched. Some people were so convinced that it was him that they were martyred for their conviction. But even some who saw him doubted that it was him at all. It seems to have existed in more than merely our dimension at one time. Yes, it was physical, but it was not merely physical. It was more than physical. It could walk through walls because it was far more solid than the walls, not because it was some sort of insubstantial phantasm. It wasn't bounded by space and time in the same way that you and I are, although if it chose, it could happily occupy our space and time in a similar way to the way that we do. And when it finally moved out of the range of human senses at the end of 40 days, it was going back to a dimension which it had never totally left, which it had always occupied in some sense during those 40 days. Understand this, or at least understand what understanding this might involve, and many of Mr. Foster's objections to the resurrection appearances simply fall away. Let's deal with one detail, the Emmaus Road. Mr. Foster said, and you heard him say, that the village of Emmaus never existed, and so it was a convenient ploy on the part of the gospel writers. This used to be said a lot, but my learned friend's out of date. As on so many occasions, archaeology has been able to confirm the accuracy of the New Testament. The gospel says that Emmaus was about 60 stadia, about 7 miles, from Jerusalem. And for millennia, its location has been a mystery. Various candidates have been suggested, but none of them fitted or fitted well enough. The prime contender was a town called Nicopolis, designed as Emmaus by the Byzantine church in the second half of the 4th century AD, and still the tourist guides preferred site. But it's too far from Jerusalem, and in the first century was a regional capital, and certainly not a village. The 12th century crusaders, for their part, thought that Emmaus Abu Ghosh, near Qirat Yearim, was the site of Emmaus, but it was not called Emmaus in the first century, so that doesn't help. And neither was the third candidate, El Quabibi, between Jerusalem and Ramallah. And the fact that these didn't fit was used as a stick to beat the gospel writer Luke, and it was wielded with good effect until 2001. Then, just off a road conveniently named the A1 between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, Emmaus rose from the dust. Jews had certainly lived there before and until AD 70. The distance was right. It had been a wealthy upper-class village, and the excavator of Emmaus, a man named Carsten Peter Theder, thinks that the wealth of the village might contain a clue as to why that curiously selective chronicler, Luke, chose the Emmaus story as the centre of his resurrection narrative. You'll recall that Luke dedicates his gospel to Most Excellent Theophilus, presumably some sort of rich patron, and exactly the sort of man who would have had friends or relations in a place just like first century Emmaus. The gospel is full of stories about Jesus' ministry to the poor, the sick, and the oppressed, but, says Mr. Theda, the discoverer of Emmaus, if Luke wanted Theophilus to understand the message of the resurrection, what better narrative could he choose than the one where two wealthy Jerusalemite Jews return to their suburban villa and are honored, as it were, by an appearance of the risen Christ? In Luke's account of the Emmaus Road, there is certainly symbolism, but that doesn't begin to mean that the events didn't happen. Mr. Foster seems to live in a bleak, reductionist, and rather miserable world. Luke plainly intends us to take the story as history, and if he didn't, he wouldn't have put in all the little falsifiable details that he has. For example, that a man has the name Cleopas, and indeed the location of the road where the meeting occurred. This is plainly not a cynical attempt to con someone into belief. If it were, Luke, who's no fool, would have edited out all the difficult bits, notably the failure to recognize Jesus during that long walk. Now, what about the ascension? Who is the fundamentalist now? Mr. Foster reads the ascension story as an Apollo liftoff. He's very patronizing, I'm afraid to say. First century Jews didn't have a two-tier picture of the universe, us down here, and God up there. They didn't think that heaven started vertically above the Mount of Olives, just past the clouds. They used vertical imagery to talk about heaven because it was good as any and better than most. But they would have found as ridiculous as Mr. Foster does the medieval picture, Christian picture, of completely bamboozled apostles straining their necks to catch the last glimpse of Jesus' feet peeping out of a cloud. Modern physicists talk about parallel universes and are not dismissed as crude literalists for doing so. First century Judaism was familiar with comparable ideas and used similar language. They would have understood the ascension story in terms similar to this. There came a time when Jesus passed out of the dimension in which our limited bodies and senses could deal with him to another dimension completely. The last time that he was accessible to us in anything like a physical human way was on the Mount of Olives near Bethany. After that, we went away and waited to see what was going to happen next. All this tells us quite a lot about how we should look at the resurrection body. Now, what about Elvis Presley? Apparently, it is right to acknowledge that the occasional hysterical oddball does think that he sees Elvis wandering around a supermarket or a petrol station. But the supermarket Elvises behave in every way as you'd expect supermarket Elvises to act. They look consistently like Elvis to the infatuated viewer. They tend to get in their car and drive away. If they come back, they still look more or less like Elvis, depending on how they've combed their hair and how deluded the viewer is. They certainly don't offer themselves for verification by skeptical critics. Large groups of people don't tend to think, all at the same time, that these Elvises look like Elvis. If they do, most would just say that the Elvises looked a bit like Elvis, and that they knew what the devotee meant by thinking that there was a likeness. The Elvises don't do anything eccentric. They don't suddenly appear in the middle of groups of previous associates. They don't talk for hours to old friends. They are eventually recognized as Elvis and then disappear. They don't give advice about what their friends should do when they go away. And if they walk into supermarket walls, they fall over. What about mass hallucinations? Well, these are the ones that are reasonably documented, assuming that they are indeed hallucinations, are of vague things. The classic example is indeed the Portugal visions of 1917, cited by my learned friend. It's true that many people reported seeing the sun approach the earth, but many things could have been meant by this. Whether the sun approaches the earth or not is very much in the eye of the beholder, which is, of course, precisely Mr. Foster's point. One can well understand how a rumor that something as vague as the sun is approaching the earth might epidemically spread amongst an expectant population and translate easily into a belief that refraction from a particular cloud was indeed the sun approaching the earth. But the post-resurrection accounts are not in that class at all. They're much more concrete, much more variable, much less expected, and seen by a much less naturally receptive audience. Hallucinations, for a start, happen hugely more often to a rare subclass of schizophrenic hallucinators than they do to the general population. And Jesus is unlikely to have recruited his followers from such a subclass. Hallucinators tend to have, on the psychiatric evidence, a lower average intelligence than the general population. And although the disciples were not posh scholars, their subsequent careers as preachers throughout and beyond the Roman world indicate that they were no fools. Several of them appear to have had their own fishing businesses on the Galilee, which would put them surprisingly high up on the financial and intellectual ladder of first century Jewry. Yes, they were bereaved, but there's a world of difference, I suggest, between the common type of bereavement hallucination and what the Gospels report. The resurrection accounts are not accounts of vague feelings of the presence of the deceased. They are not mere voices in the no man's land between sleep and waking. They're not sensations of a hand upon a shoulder in a turbulent night. They're conversations, meals, and journeys. The psychiatric label multimodal doesn't begin to describe what the Gospels describe. And no doubt the disciples, if the point is taken, felt that they had let Jesus down, but Jesus doesn't start off with absolution and rehabilitation. In fact, that's left to the end, and entirely in context with the commissioning of Peter. Yes, the disciples were stressed and relatively sleepless, but the sleeplessness wasn't, and the stresses weren't akin to hostage stresses. If the disciples had been more stressed and completely unslept, the literature might suggest that they might see something like pink elephants floating in front of their eyes. There's nothing to suggest that they would see and hear, and all of them at the same time, a man delivering a theology lesson, or weeks after the first appearance, the same man cooking fish on the beach. Did the disciples expect to see Jesus? Is that the problem, that it was anticipation? Well, first, the psychiatric context. There's no doubt that expectant people are more likely than non-expectant people to have a hallucinatory experience of the things they're expecting. It's equally clear that while increasing expectancy does increase the incidence, the number of hallucinations, it does not increase the quality of the hallucination. So, if Peter, for example, was certain that he was going to see Jesus again, that would be likely to increase the chance of a vision of Jesus. It would not make Jesus' body appear more solid than it would have been if Peter was merely fairly confident that he would see Jesus and had a vision of him. You can't explain Thomas's complete satisfaction that he'd seen a particularly solid Jesus by saying that Jesus had been told in no, sorry, that Thomas had been told in no uncertain terms by the other disciples whom he trusted that Jesus would appear that night, which of course is not the evidence anyway. But the evidence does not suggest that the disciples expected to see Jesus again. Jesus had told the disciples that he would be betrayed, killed, and will rise again on the third day. What was their response? They did not understand what he was saying, quote, and were afraid to ask him. If they had understood it, they would surely not be cowering in Jerusalem. They would not have been astonished at his appearances. They would have been standing by, waiting for further instructions. There would have been no need for Jesus' swinging denunciation on the road to Emmaus of the disciples' faithlessness. Quote, then he said to them, oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? Close quotes. If, however, the disciples, contrary to their appalling track record of systematically misunderstanding almost everything that Jesus ever said to them, even if they had remembered and understood those words about seeing Jesus again in Galilee, or had their memories jogged by the empty tomb angels, it cannot have been those words which led anyone to imagine that he first appeared, as Matthew, Luke, and John all agree he did, in Jerusalem. The mention of Galilee would positively inoculate their psyches against any apparition in Jerusalem. I've dealt with Mr. Foster's argument so far on the presumption that if person A has a hallucination, it's perfectly feasible for person B also to have the same hallucination. But of course, it's not remotely feasible. It doesn't happen like that. If one stressed, tired person thought that he saw a pink elephant, an identically stressed, tired person in identical circumstances wouldn't conjure up a pink elephant as well. Such a phenomenon is completely unknown to psychology or psychiatry. Yet if you accept Mr. Foster's reconstruction, not only did many of the disciples see, hear, and touch a pink elephant, but they all saw, heard, and touched it at the same time, and, which is something different, all believed that they had really seen, heard, and touched an objective pink elephant. So the idea that hallucinations might explain the post-resurrection appearances is not seriously arguable. And it's hardly surprising, in those circumstances, that almost all of Christianity's opponents have quietly dropped the idea from their books.
I'm a barrister. I take any brief that people ask me to take. My own personal view is that what I've been saying this morning is complete and utter gibberish. And I believe that the evidence plainly suggests that Jesus did indeed rise from the dead.
Okay, so hopefully you all got that at the end. But Charles gave the arguments against the resurrection very clearly because it's something he's really, really looked into. What we're going to do now, we're going to have 5 minutes, and in that 5 minutes, if you want to write down a question that comes in your mind about the resurrection, feel free to do so, or you may think of one. Then we're just going to have a time of questions, which I'm going to give to Charles, as he's done a lot of research on this subject, and we'll carry on then. So you've got 5 minutes. If you've all got pens and paper, maybe you haven't got a question, but if you do, we'll give you 5 minutes, and then we'll finish off the time with some questions. Thanks.